You're free now. Free to stream beyond your wildest dreams. Free to be everything you imagine, and then some. That's how it feels to have Quantum Fiber. Your world unleashed. Learn more at quantumfiber.com. Limited availability. Service in select locations only.
Hey, it's Brother One.
And Brother Two.
From Two Brothers Mattress. You'll spend 33% of this year on your mattress. That's almost 3,000 hours. Start sleeping comfortably now on a new Tempur-Pedic mattress.
Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
With our lowest price guarantee
and our 100-night trial,
your locally owned Two Brothers mattress is your number one choice for Tempur-Pedic mattresses. Visit one of our five stores or twobrothersmattress.com.
Twobrothersmattress.com.
Today on First Lady and Friends, we had a great conversation with Neil Abercrombie. He is the senior advisor for legislative affairs and policy for the administration, the Cox administration, formerly of Utah State. And we talked a lot about his time at Utah State and the things he's working on now. Can't wait for you to take a listen. Let's get proximate. Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. Today we have a guest who I've known for many, many years, who has become a dear friend, a fellow Aggie, and entrenched in Aggie world. And so we really connect on a lot of levels. Just a really stellar human. We have Neil Abercrombie here. He is now not with Utah State anymore, but welcome to the show, Neil.
Yeah, thank you, Abby. We could spend the entire time just talking about Utah State University if you want.
Yes, it's, go Aggies.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I have a friend who thinks that Go Cougars is trying to be a thing for her. And I said, no, it's not a thing.
Yeah.
It's just Go Aggies. Yeah. That's the way it goes.
Yeah.
So let's go back to where you grew up. I know we both come from rural backgrounds, and I love hearing your stories about your growing up and your parents there in southern Idaho, right?
Yep.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I grew up in a really small town in southeastern Idaho, Aberdeen, which if anybody spent much time in southeastern Idaho, it's right off the I-15 freeway between kind of Pocatello and Idle Falls. And I say just right off the freeway, and my wife reminds me, you know, it's actually a pretty long drive off the freeway. It's about 30 miles through potato fields to end up in my hometown. But I truly grew up in the middle of potato fields in Idaho. Population of my hometown is probably about 1,100 people. My graduating class at Aberdeen High was about 90, or it was probably about, it was less than that. It was probably like 60 students in my graduating class. So small town Idaho. My mom still lives there. Some family still in southeastern Idaho, some in Utah. So, yeah, it's born and raised, same house, same community the entire time. So loved it. It was great.
And tell me a little bit. So you were there kind of on a farm too, right?
Yeah. So we grew up. I mean, everybody there grows up with a connection to agriculture. My family, actually, my parents were both educators. Mm-hmm. So the recent conference you had couple weeks ago on Show Up for Teachers that resonated with me personally, because both of my parents were teachers. My mom was a fourth grade teacher, and then she was the librarian of what's really a community library in my hometown area. It was the high school library that also served as the community library. And my dad was a high school science teacher and then also the advisor for the FFA club there. So,
of course,
both very embedded into the public school system, educators, and so we always had a connection to agriculture. We were not necessarily farming as, you know, as much as growing up in the middle of it.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting is even though Idaho, you know, it's really close, southern Idaho, a lot of similarities, a lot of connections to Utah. But I think people don't realize, you know, in Utah, the way our pioneers designed things that the community, they were really big on this sense of community, which I think is really neat and unique to Utah, where the little towns were where you lived, but your farms were really on the outside. Now, Idaho, just over the border, it's very different.
Yeah, it's very different.
You are, most of the farm homes are on the farm.
Yep.
They're not in the town. So when you talk about how spread out it is and how people farms are all around you. So it's an interesting difference there.
Yeah. I mean, I say I grew up in Aberdeen, but technically if we drove to my hometown, I grew up in Sterling because that's about 10 miles outside of Aberdeen. And it's truly in the middle of potato farms. And it's probably a little similar to maybe what you see in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Where you have like more of the prairie homes and the farms surrounding it. And then people drive into the town for, you know, church or school or other things like that, rather than everybody living there and then driving out to the farm.
Yeah.
Which is more of the pioneer Utah way.
Yeah. And I always felt a little weird because growing up in Mount Pleasant, I actually was outside of Mount Pleasant on a farm, and all of my friends, they lived in town.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
they would, you know, their farms, or, you know, if they had farms, were always outside of town, which is what Spencer did. His they lived in town and their farm was outside of town, which is, it's just interesting.
It is. It's different. And, you know, it's interesting too, because we talk about agriculture in Utah is such an important part of who we are and our identification, and especially rural Utah. Idaho, it is that times 10, you know, because the commodities are, there's so much more quantity of production that's happening, whether it's, you know, sugar beets or onions or potatoes, of course. And the scale is much, much more significant, even just a couple hours north of the border.
Yeah, it's really an interesting situation that we have.
Truly.
Utah always considers itself very agricultural. I think most of us sort of have some tie, grandparents, great-grandparents that had, you know, ties to agriculture. But we really are quite an urban state. People don't realize that, which is, it's interesting. So talk a little bit more about your family. So you had your parents, and you had how many siblings, and you all grew up there? And
yeah. So, my parents actually lived in California for a few years after they got married. Shortly after they got married, my dad got his master's degree at Oregon State University, and then he ended up doing some research in California at UC Berkeley, animal science research. And so had a couple of my older siblings that were born in California. And then they decided they really wanted to raise their family in Idaho. My mom's parents were from Aberdeen, Idaho. My dad's parents were from Aberdeen, Idaho. So they were already
going
second
home.
Generation. So they were going home, and they decided they wanted to raise their family back on the farm. So myself and then my older sister, the older sister closest to me, we were born in Idaho. My older siblings were born outside of the state. So I'm the youngest of six. Mm-hmm. It was really, really great opportunity for them to come home. They were close to both sets of grandparents for me. My grandfather on my mom's side was a cattle rancher and had a cattle ranch also in southeastern Idaho. And then my grandfather on my dad's side, paternal side, he worked for USDA and did crop inspections, mm-hmm. Both with potatoes and sugar beets, and then would go to California during the summer months and spring and do inspections of the fruit harvest in California. So both sides of my family were pretty embedded into the agricultural community just from different angles.
Yeah, that's incredible and such great lessons. I'm sure you learned. What do you think was the biggest takeaway from growing up in that environment?
Yeah, it's interesting because if someone who knew me really well then, or even some of my older siblings, if they heard you ask me that question, they would probably be rolling their eyes a little bit at my answer. Because as the youngest, and you probably have some people you know, they would be like, oh, you never really worked on the farm. Like, what lessons did you learn growing up on the farm of like industrious approach to kind of an agrarian kind of approach to life? I admit I was not the farm kid as much as maybe my older siblings were, in part just because, you know, things change over time, and you've seen this, you know, my grandfather sold the cattle ranch when I was pretty young and retired, and, you know, things start to change. I would say a couple of things that I loved growing up where I grew up, and they're still part of maybe my ethos now, is truly a sense of community, maybe even more than what, you know, specific industry anybody was involved in, and a sense of kind of an egalitarian sense of that community. Like, there wasn't a stratification in my hometown of the lawyer's kids and the kids of the CEO or the doctor. It was just, you all worked related to the farm. yeah. in some capacity. And there wasn't kind of an equal setting that happened, that I felt. And also in a small town, I mean, you know, you talk about Texas and Friday Night Lights, but yeah. even in Idaho, you know, we had a home basketball game and there are 1,000 people live in my hometown and there would be 800 that would be at the basketball game,
exactly.
you know, just yeah. a real sense of you're really connected to everybody. You know, there's a part where it's nice to get out of that and have a little mm-hmm. anonymity, maybe somewhere else. But my dad, especially, and I think I've adopted it, loved going to the post office and knowing everybody there and going to the grocery store and knowing everybody there and just this deep connection to everybody you interacted with on a daily basis.
Yeah. Yeah. It's comforting in a way. When you've lived there a long time,
yeah.
sometimes it gets a little intrusive.
Yep,
sometimes.
It can be a little smothering at times, right?
But yeah. at the same time, I mean, it does. It's this balance of people who genuinely care about you and want to take care of you and connect with you versus people are in your business.
Yeah.
And that's also weirdly comforting sometimes,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, very similar to the experience that you had growing up, where it's the pros and the cons.
Yeah, so. And I, it's funny because Spencer, there for a while, he was you know, the mayor, and he worked at the phone company, and all the things in town that, you know, and he wore a lot of different hats. And he's finally said to me, Abby, I can't go to the post office. You're going to have to go. I will never get out of there.
Yeah.
Which, again, is really endearing and sweet.
Yeah.
But also, when you're in a hurry, you can't.
Maybe a little exhausting at the same
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, so my wife grew up in Utah, and she went to a large high school. So she had a very different experience. I mean, her high school was basically – the enrollment of her high school was bigger than my hometown. And so we've debated the pros and cons of both quite a bit. And I had what she would characterize a little bit more like the Saved by the Bell yeah. high school experience, where it's like you did everything because there was nobody else. If you wanted to do it, you did it. And when we were dating and I said something about like, oh, yeah, you know, we had this football game, and she kind of looked at me and she's like, you played high school football? I'm like, oh, yeah, I lettered as a sophomore.
Of course I did. Yeah.
Yeah, of course. You know, and she's like, yeah, I don't think you would have made the team at my high school. you know, while I was able to do everything, the reverse was, you know, her high school, she had like Shakespearean literature and yeah. French and, you know, Italian, all of these different course offerings where no way my rural school are yeah. we taking a French class, you know, yeah. like there's limitations too on that. So
it's true. There are trade-offs, and that's kind of what we're dealing with now. You know, we had all three of our boys doing high school at home and in Mount Pleasant at the high school there. And then now we have our daughter here in Salt Lake, and seeing her frustrations of, well, I want to do this and I want to do that, and I want to do all the things my brothers did. And she's not able to,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
but at the same time, she's taking an AP class that my boys didn't have any opportunity to take academically. I keep reminding her, you'll be so much further ahead yeah, academically.
Yeah. yeah.
But it's a trade-off. And,
it's a trade-off,
and
yeah.
you do, I think, you know, I appreciate that, you know, I was able to do a lot of things. I think Spencer loves that he was able to do a lot of different things. But yeah, yeah, we didn't have the greatest academic experience.
Yeah, limited on some of those offerings for sure.
Yeah. So, well, I want to get into what you've been doing and what you're doing now when we come right back.
I'm Jeff Kaplan from KSL News Radio. You want to receive the latest news, traffic, and weather all in one place? All you have to do is subscribe to the KSL text line. Text the word news to 57500 and you'll get the latest news, traffic, and weather updates. Sometimes before we get them on the air. I'll catch you on the radio weekday afternoons on KSL News Radio.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter, and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back here with Neil Abercrombie. He is, let's talk a little bit about where you were.
Yeah.
You've you've been a long time at Utah State, like we mentioned, and you've made a transition recently. So let's talk about your work at Utah State before we get into that.
Yeah, so I spent the last 11 years at Utah State University as the Vice President of Government Relations. As we talked about a little bit at the beginning, it's our alma mater for each of us. So I had already loved Utah State before moving into that role. I didn't really know what the role was, to be honest, before I was hired. It was something that was kind of, I didn't even know the position existed. President Stan Albrecht hired me at the end of, 2010. And I already loved a lot about Utah State, but I didn't know a lot about Utah State. So I moved into that position really to be, the chief advocate or lobbyist for the university, both on Capitol Hill in Salt Lake and also in Washington, D.C. So I worked closely with President Albrecht and the other university leaders, really advancing the mission of Utah State. And I could go on for days about my passion for Utah State, in part because of its land-grant mission. And we talked about rural America a little bit, rural Idaho, rural Utah. Land-grant universities are really embedded in kind of a rural society across the nation. Iowa State, Penn State, Oregon State, Nebraska, Lincoln, these other land-grant universities across the nation are embedded with kind of a service dynamic to the research that faculty are doing. There's faculty for Utah State University all around the state of Utah, mostly in rural communities. So I really love that opportunity, getting to know the students, the faculty, the research areas, and trying to advance that mission on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, and it's you did a phenomenal job, and people knew you all over for really highlighting Utah State and just showing off how awesome they are, because they are. So it's got to be an easy job.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
Ish.
Yeah, you totally. I mean, my job was so much easier than a lot of other folks on Capitol Hill because there was this natural credibility that came with Utah State University as a partner in delivering solutions in communities. You go out to Vernal, and chances are someone knows a faculty member that's there that's working on an interesting issue around ozone and clean air or something like that. Like you're right. There was a degree of credibility that made my job so much easier just based on the institution and who I was representing.
Yeah. And there's some really incredible things happening at Utah State right now. I mean, talk a little bit about the grants that we've $1 billion.
Yeah. So Utah State, they received $1 billion project for the next 10 years, just at the Space Dynamics Lab alone last year. And one of the things that's, not to go too far in the weeds on this, but one thing that was really unique with Utah State University is there's a lot of research that's happening on kind of the main campus, the academic side. The Space Dynamics Lab, which a lot of people don't necessarily know about, but if you live in Cache Valley, you absolutely know about it. It's what's called a university-affiliated research center, which about 50 years ago, the federal government and the Department of Defense selected about 10 universities across the nation to be essentially sole source research universities. So John Hopkins, Georgia Tech, MIT, Nebraska, Lincoln, a few schools like that, and they chose Utah State to be their partner with Missile Defense Authority. So there is this, when I talk about kind of the partnerships with the government, Department of Defense can turn over a research project to Utah State University's Space Dynamics Lab, have them work on it. There's also really cool NASA projects, the James Webb Telescope that we're all talking about, the images of, Utah State University because of SDL had a part in some of the instruments with that telescope. So that was not only always exciting for me to go, but it was really fun to see the students engaged in those projects and the faculty and the different, leaders that were working on those grants and contracts.
Yeah. So we're really proud of our Aggies. We're really proud of, if you didn't notice, but we think they're doing great things. Let's get into you recently made, after being there so long, you made a transition. I'm sure it was an agonizing decision.
Yeah.
Actually, I know it was.
Yeah.
But talk a little bit about your transition and what you're doing now.
Yeah. So it was actually kind of during the holiday break this last year. So right around kind of between Christmas and New Year's. I knew this opportunity was opening up with Governor Cox. And it was something where it was really tough. I love Utah State. I loved what I was doing. But I really saw Governor Cox as a unique leader, not only in Utah, but really nationally, as someone who really was addressing big issues in a consensus building way of not just using the platform of elected office to talk about things, but to really drive policy solutions. And as much as I loved Utah State and what I'd been doing there, I wanted to be involved in some of these big picture issues for the state of Utah. And I saw it as a unique opportunity to really be a part of that. So in January, I transitioned from Utah State to this role. So senior advisor for legislative affairs and policy, worked closely with the governor, lieutenant governor, the cabinet, senior staff on really trying to advance the governor's priorities and vision on this. And I love it. It's been exactly what I hoped it would be, both in tone and approach to these issues. It's a very thoughtful administration that wants to understand the problem before throwing solutions at it. And to me, having spent the last 10 or 11 years at Utah State University, a lot of the issues that I was really passionate about are still issues that the Cox administration's passionate about. Rural Utah, our natural resources, education. These were things that, of course, I was already advocating for, and now I can see them from a little different vantage point and continue to work on them.
Yeah. It's been fun to have you. It's just, you're just such a great part of the team, and we're working on big things.
Yeah.
One of those big things is higher education, and just talk maybe a little bit. You've been in higher education for so many years. There's a little disruption maybe coming to higher ed, and there's a lot that maybe people don't understand about higher education and maybe the issues. I mean, we're seeing maybe some workforce things that maybe transitioning higher ed into something it hasn't been before, some kind of a hybrid of how do we get the workforce of the future when we still are doing higher education maybe the way we did it for so many years? And does higher ed need to change with and adapt to the new environment we're in?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of elements there that, of course, I've thought a lot about both in my previous role and my current role. I'll try to be brief on this, but there's a lot that I could say here. But let me give you just really brief maybe history as I've thought about those questions you just asked. So when I started working for Utah State about 11 years ago, I did think it was going to be a totally easy job. That advocating for higher ed was like advocating for baseball and apple pie. Like, it was about as American as anything else. It was just an understood proposition that higher ed was good for society. And that first legislative session, there was a very prominent Utah State senator that said he felt like our universities and colleges in Utah were graduating students with degrees to nowhere, mm-hmm. especially in the liberal arts. And I personally studied philosophy and political science, so that I took a little bit of personal offense to it.
I think you and Spencer are the only ones that graduated in political science that are working in political science.
There's definitely this question of like, what are you going to do with this degree?
Right.
And this state senator just called that out and said, what are we doing graduating these students? And we're not really preparing them for the workforce that they need to. And suddenly it put us in an advocacy position, a little bit on our heels, mm-hmm. of how are we defining the value of higher ed? It's not just this understood outcome that you pay $10,000, $40,000, or in some cases $100,000 to get a diploma, you're going to see a return on that. And that was 10 years ago, and that criticism has just gotten louder and bigger. So a couple of things that I feel on this. There absolutely needs to be some massive reform and some disruption. My bias standpoint, I think there's some elements of higher ed that are very, very good in this. And I think Utah is in a great spot because, relatively speaking, our tuition is pretty affordable. Our pathways to good careers are really good in this state. You look at kind of what lawmakers are usually concerned about are kind of the stranded individuals that maybe invest in a degree but don't graduate, so they don't have the outcome. That's a high concern to them. Utah does pretty good on that, but we absolutely could improve a ton there. I think the land grants are usually pretty well connected in this, but there's a lot of barriers to really reforming the academic side to match workforce. Some of it is, we used to say, reforming higher ed is a little bit like turning a large cruise ship versus a speedboat.
Yeah.
You know, like very incremental change takes time. It's not, you can't totally change the direction of an academic program overnight. That's been the historical piece. I think there needs to be an acceleration of that. I'll give you one example, you know, competency based. You know, do we start to recognize someone who has spent a summer selling something door to door that they don't need to take five courses in sales to get their degree in business? You know, maybe there's something there that we should start addressing. And I think higher ed's looking at it more. You know, Mitch Daniels in Indiana at Purdue University. Of course, we talk about Michael Crow at Arizona State. I think right here in the state, I think Utah State and UVU, Brad Moore. I mean, I think you have innovative leaders, Taylor Randall, of course. You have innovative leaders right now that would agree with everything you said, Abby, and are trying to address it. There's just some built-in hurdles that make it harder to move that needle.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, just as a, you know, somebody that went to college, somebody that has three kids going to college this fall, I think it is changing. The students are changing, and so we have to sort of adapt with it. And the workforce is changing. So as higher ed, you know, they will change, and they will figure it out. And but also, I don't ever want to lose that. There's a lot more that you learn in your university or college experience than just sheer academics or work preparation or labor, you know, preparation. Yeah. For me, there's some real life lessons, life experiences that I think you don't, it doesn't show up on the sort of the spreadsheet of benefits.
Totally. I couldn't agree more with that. And there is this kind of dual focus that our universities have played and need to play in our community and back to rural America. I mean, for me, growing up in the small town I grew up, it really was my experience as an undergrad where I started to meet people with diverse ideas, diverse backgrounds, challenging some of these pieces. And that awareness is probably more beneficial than anything I studied in the classroom. That said, there are a lot of students that they want the fast track to the computer science degree so they get on the job market and move on. I mean, and there has to be a path for that too. So how do universities continue to foster this space for diverse ideas and opinions and backgrounds, really, that happens when people move there and locate and get together. I know you talk about being proximate and the proximity of, you know, I think that's so essential to what a university is. That's hard to do if everybody's learning online and doing a fast track program, you know?
Yeah. And then you sort of miss out on that.
Yeah.
Those kinds of opportunities. But at the same time, I sit here and try to think of, you know, the technology that changes, we're adapting. What, I mean, did we see a big shift during the pandemic of people saying, I don't want to come be on campus, I would rather be elsewhere? Also, did we see a real change in how these 18, 19-year-olds are coming to us as freshmen, just emotionally? Maybe not as mature as they've been in the past because of the lack of connection these last couple of years?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit both. I think we see the freshman class of the last year or two really craving the social interaction because they missed out on a lot of that during their junior or senior year of high school experience. So those that did move to a college campus, I think they really wanted all of the engagement outside of the classroom in addition to the in-person learning of a class. The online experience of a student, I think that was already changing quite a bit. You know, I think students were already demanding more flexibility in the courses. They wanted to take a class on the weekend or in the evening so they could work. Or in Utah, you know, many students are married or maybe they have family obligations. There's other things that they're trying to balance their course activity with. So there were already a lot of demands for that diversity. COVID just accelerated that a ton. I think now you're starting to see some surveys back that some things universities have gotten pretty good at as far as delivering online content and I think adapting to the way different students learn that way. There's been some really good feedback. And then at the same time, there's some examples where it's not a great replacement for the in-person learning.
Yeah.
And I think it gets back to higher ed's never going to go back to just a real traditional in-person ivory tower perception, you know, the way it has been. It's always going to have a dual role.
Briefly, just touch on maybe the, I know mental health is a huge issue.
Yeah.
Across the board, but we're seeing a huge demand for mental health services on our campuses, in our universities or colleges. What do you, do you see that getting better? Do you see the universities being able to adapt to that? What are you seeing?
Yeah, so this was eye-opening to me a few years ago. When I was at USU, there was a student body president and student leaders that drafted a student resolution declaring a mental health crisis on our college campus.
Wow.
And they came and met with me in my advocacy role and said, what do we do? You know, we don't have enough resources. We don't have the connections. And they, the students, drafted a statewide resolution that they took to Capitol Hill to raise awareness to this issue. The students also, student-led, implemented a student fee to go to hire more therapists for mental health. It was the students that really kind of elevated this discussion on our campus, basically saying it is reaching a crisis point. There's so many bottlenecks as far as like, you know, therapy. There are a lot of great things happening with like Safe UT and really providing opportunities. But a lot of those opportunities are really at like acute crisis.
Yeah. Yeah.
What we're finding is sometimes just a peer-to-peer connection.
Yeah.
One of the most successful things that I think a lot of universities have done is creating a peer mentoring system, whether that's first generation students that are maybe sophomores or juniors meeting with first generation students that are incoming freshmen and talking to them about, yeah, college is hard, or being a 19 or 20 year old where you're balancing work and school and family pressure. And you're also still at a point in your life where maybe developmentally you're changing, you know, all of these things are hard. To not have someone to talk to, and maybe you're living alone for the first time, all of these factors, it can start to snowball and get out of control pretty quickly if you don't have somebody that says, oh, that's totally normal. You know, let's talk about that. Or there's ways that you can deal with this anxiety or this stress. And that was one thing that these student leaders really, they were amazing at delivering that message, because as you can imagine, a lot of these individuals were students you would think of, oh, they're on top of this. They're A students. They're engaged. They don't have a problem. And they were like, no, I'm dealing with anxiety. I'm dealing with depression. I'm dealing with avoidance. You know, I'm dealing with all of these things. And it's not just a student in isolation. It's all of us. So that's a long-winded way of saying I think we're getting better.
Yeah.
We're certainly not there yet. And there are resources that are available to enrolled students that I worry that sometimes are not available to the 18 or 19 year old that's not enrolled in a university, that's maybe not embedded in, you know, doesn't have a peer mentor assigned to them because they're not living on a college campus, or, you know, there are a lot of youth out there that I worry that we still are not connecting them with the resources that we need to.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It's such a tough issue. You are also working on some really important projects with the state right now. And I want to get into those when we come right back.
Did you know you can get the three things you need to know delivered right to you? Just go to KSLNewsRadio.com, click on menu, and then newsletter.
Or go to the KSL News Radio app and you click on menu, and then it's email alerts.
This is even easier. Just text the word inbox to 57500.
Get the top national and local stories with the three things you need to know newsletter.
The murder of two men forces their families to wrestle with impossible questions. Who is forgiveness for? Does everyone deserve a second chance? Follow season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back here on First Lady and Friends with Neil Abercrombie. He's in the administration now here in Salt Lake. And you're living here. No, you're Logan, still Logan.
Yeah. No, still Logan. Yeah.
Well, know. We know how that commute Valley. Goes.
Yeah.
It's a little better than it used to be in the in the 90s when we were making it, and the, there was construction. Well, there's always construction.
Yeah. But. You know, it's fine.
Well, hey, I want to get into, you're doing some really incredible things. There are some big issues around the state. When we were campaigning, I'm telling you, there, one thing comes up over and over and over again and still continues to, because it's been a huge issue, affordable housing.
Yeah.
One of the biggest factors of happiness that people talk about is having your kids and grandkids around you as you get older. Mm-hmm. I think that goes back to this sense of community. And what the fear is, and there was another statistic that I think the highest level since like 50 years or more, I think it was pre-World War II maybe. Maybe it was 70. I can't remember that. I shouldn't be saying this when I don't understand what's what it is. But there are more adult children living in their parents' home than since forever. And that's an issue.
Yeah.
And there's a huge issue with us being able to afford. I mean, I'm thinking about my kids graduating from college. There's no way that they're affording a house right now. So let's, it's a huge issue, and there's no one single, you know, magic bullet or we would have done it. So talk a little bit about the stuff you're working on with affordable housing.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one where I had mentioned earlier, you know, joining the Governor Cox administration, I really wanted to get involved in big issues. And this is, it doesn't get any bigger than this. And it really is related to the larger issue of growth and the stress that growth is putting on our communities, both in the use of natural resources and land, but really the pressures with cost of living here. And you're right. I mean, we would take it for granted that, you know, children, their children, they'd all be able to afford to live in the same community that we live. And I was in a meeting the other day and someone asked the question, how many of you in the room, we're not talking about, you know, 19, 20 year olds, but professionals, you know, middle of their careers, or, you know, how many of you could afford to buy the house you're currently living in? And a lot of people are, you know, probably couldn't now with their current job buy the current house that they're in. So what are we doing about it? You know, I talked a lot about my experience working at Utah State University. Before Utah State University, I worked at the Utah League of Cities and Towns and worked closely with all the different municipal governments across the state. And I still have a very deep passion for the role of local government. And this is one where sometimes it's a tense relationship between the state and local government as far as who's helping solve the problem and maybe who's restricting opportunities. And I think our local government entities are doing a lot. I think they have a lot of pressure from their constituents saying that we don't want this kind of development in our backyard. There's a lot of NIMBYism when it comes to this. And I think all of us in Utah need to think a little bit more broadly.
Yeah.
Maybe think of mixed-use developments in a way that we maybe didn't want in our neighborhood, and think about diversity of housing. I think condos, for example, sometimes people would look at them as like renters that would bring down property values in a community. And now sometimes you have these condos that are selling to first-time homebuyers at $500,000. You know, these are not... these are not property values that are diminishing the community. And I think thinking about that. So a couple of things that we're working on, we're spending a lot of time looking at the use of housing in a local community. And what I mean by that is short-term rentals have increased significantly. They were already on the rise in Utah well before COVID. COVID definitely accelerated that. There's data probably shows anywhere from 20 to 25,000 homes in Utah that are on the short-term rental market. You know, some of those could be used for first-time home buyers or renter long-term rentals. So those are a couple of things we're working with our local communities on. Looking at our major infrastructure zones, so where the state has invested in transit hubs, and you go to, you know, you go to Washington, D.C., and you take the metro around, any metro stop you get off, there's a huge housing complex right next to it. There's demand to live next to transit. We're a little slower in the West towards that mentality, but I think we're getting better. You know, Farmington is working on a pretty cool high-density mixed-use development project next to their transit hub. And communities that you maybe don't always think of that are doing that are doing some really cool things. So how we in the governor's office can work with those communities, support them, assist them, and maybe help in some other areas on some policy reform.
Yeah. And yeah, like I said, it's so many things that, that come together to try to help this, and it's no one answer.
Yeah. Well, and at the end of the day, you know, demand is demand, and a lot of people want to be in Utah right now. And so
And for the first time, I think, in many, many years, people in migration is actually more than our internal growth.
It is. And also the first time in many years, Utahns are perceiving growth as a negative to our quality of life.
Yeah.
Before, for the last couple of decades, we were pretty positive about growth because we saw it as stimulating our economy and
jobs
building up Utah
and
all of these things. And
yeah.
Now I think a lot of Utahns are starting to see it as diminishing our quality of life. It's creating congestion. It's creating reduction in access to trails and, you know, a lot of things that we value in addition to the housing market.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Before we end, I want to really quickly, one really important thing that you're working on, it's really something I am really excited to hear what you're doing on it, but you're doing some things around domestic violence. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So domestic violence, sexual violence are things that are really concerning, I think, to not only the governor, but a number of our colleagues in the cabinet and in the executive branch. It's one where we are a really safe state, and on most metrics of criminal activity, we're below national averages. And when it comes to violence against women, and we're higher. And there's things that we could do better. Some of it is maybe some better coordination and messaging. Some of it is maybe some enhancements on the criminal side. This conversation has kind of started a little bit with gun safety and access to guns on the domestic violence. If someone's a perpetrator, if there's an issue of domestic violence, making sure that they don't have access to weapons. And we've seen that with a large percent of the homicides that happen in Utah are domestic violence related or intimate partner violence of some sort. And it's not one single thing. This involves multiple different entities of state government, you know, from inclusion and equity to public safety and health and human services. And we really are trying to pull together all of those different resources and also a number of state lawmakers that are really concerned about this space too, and see if there's something that we can do more to keep our communities safe in those areas.
Yeah, I love that. I think breaking those cycles of violence, we've talked a little bit about that, and you know, keeping not only adults, you know, the women safe, but children and growing up in that, we've been working a lot in the foster space. We've been looking, you know, working with that. It's really important to address that. We don't want to have to remove children because there's violence in the home.
Yeah. And some of it is just I appreciate you bringing it up because some of it is just being comfortable talking about it as an issue that needs to be addressed, I think is a big part of this. And that's something back to my experience at Utah State that we tried to do more, you know, certainly college students are often in a situation like this and spending more time talking about healthy relationships and what that needs as far as the dialogue and the support. So I think I'm optimistic about it. I know it's a heavy topic, but I think there's a lot the state can do to improve in that area, and we're working on it.
That's amazing. Well, I know our time is short, and I so appreciate you coming in and speaking with us and telling us all the amazing things that are going on and the things that are being worked on. I think sometimes people don't realize all the ins and outs and the intricacies of this policy work. And so I really, really appreciate you doing that. We look forward to seeing you again.
Yeah. And likewise, I know a lot of the initiatives you have are overlap with a lot of things that we're working on Capitol Hill. And next time I get to come back and ask you questions.
Perfect. Let's do it. Okay. Thanks, Neil. Appreciate
Thanks,
it.
Abby.
Two young fathers are shot to death outside an iconic Utah restaurant.
I said, your dad has been hurt really bad.
The grief was disorienting for those left behind until one choice changed everything.
I just remember writing this letter and it wasn't me writing it.
Can a personal decision shape generations?
We're all falling for this guy's trick.
I'm Amy Donaldson. Season 2 of The Letter, Ripple Effect, is available now. Follow us at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.